and I just ran right out of there. Got in my car, drove home. But when I got home, I realized I was still smiling. I was happy for them. They made a lot of sense together. I thought, I'll bet they get married. And I never thought that about anybody.
Warren. I think I finished my last track somewhere in December. I remember thinking I was ready for this album to be done so we could get back on the road. I wanted the crowds and cheering and the groupies and the drugs. Also, something they don't tell you when you buy a houseboat, it's very easy to get cabin fever. That's really meant to be more of a weekend thing.
As we all got done with our parts on the album, we started taking off, taking a much-needed break. When Graham and I had laid down everything we were supposed to do, we rented a place in Carmel for a few weeks, just the two of us. A cabin, the beach, the trees, well, and shrooms.
Graham, I think Eddie and Pete went back to the East Coast for their mom's birthday or something.
I needed to let loose. After our parents' anniversary party, Pete and Jenny stayed with our parents, and I spent about 2 weeks in New York.
There wasn't anything left for me to do. I'd recorded my vocals. The album cover was done. Our tour dates weren't set yet. I said, screw it. I'm going to Phuket. I needed a trip to clear my head.
I took a little bit of time off, but then I went back in the studio with Teddy, and we went through that album second by second, track by track, and we remixed and remixed and remixed until it was perfect. Teddy, Artie, and I were in the control room for what felt like 20 hours a day for 3 weeks or something. Occasionally, I'd get in there and record some of the instruments when we felt like a riff wasn't exactly right, or we wanted to add tack piano or a dobro or some brushes on the drum, simple stuff.
Artie Snyder. It was one album when everyone left, and when everyone came back, it was a different album. It was much more nuanced, layered, innovative. Teddy and Billy went in and filled in all the air. They added cowbells and shakers and claves and scrapers. I think at one point, we even recorded the sound of Billy's fist hitting the side of the arm of a chair because we liked the hollow sound it made. Teddy and Billy had a real vision. They had a keen sense for how the songs needed to build, and Teddy had a real focus on momentum. You take a song like Regret Me, which, when they started with it, was just the one vocal and a pretty simple shuffle, and Teddy pretty much forced Billy to get in there and do a whole second vocal layer. Billy didn't want to at first, but by the end of it, he'd put a big stamp on that song. He rewrote and recorded the main riff. He and Teddy pulled Warren's drums back until the pre-chorus. I mean, they made it a new song. On Aurora, Billy slowed it down, thinned out Karen's keys, and turned Graham way up. It became much cleaner. Teddy and Billy, and it got to be me, too, we had a shorthand. We were having fun with it. I think that really shows. I think it shows on the final cut. The final mix of that album is dynamite material.
When we had the songs how we wanted them, Teddy and I gave a lot of thought to the song order. People like it when you make them sad, I think, but people hate it when you leave them sad. Great albums have to be roller coasters that end on top. You gotta leave people with a little bit of hope. So we thought for a real long time about the track list. We had to get that just right. We ordered it thematically and instrumentally. You start big and bold, chasing the night. Things start getting more intense with This Could Get Ugly. Then Impossible Woman is wild and dark. It has a haunting quality to it. Turn It Off takes off running. It's an anthem. Please is desperate. There's urgency and begging. You turn to side B. Young Stars is tortured but up-tempo. It's a little dangerous, but you can dance to it. And then you go right into Regret Me, which is hard and fast and raw. Then come down off it with Midnights, which gets a little sweeter. You lead into A Hope Like You, slow and tender and wistful and Spartan. And then, you know, the sun comes up at the end. You leave on a high note, you go out with a bang. Aurora. Sprawling and lush and percussive. The whole album. It's a great ride. Start to finish.
Simone. I was in Manhattan when I got a postcard from Daisy from Thailand. For the first few days I was in Thailand, I just wanted to decompress. I had this idea that I would go somewhere alone and maybe reflect on myself. Obviously, that didn't happen. 2 days in, I was going stir crazy. I was almost about to book myself a flight home 5 days early.
The postcard she sent just said, "Come to Phuket. Bring coke and lipstick."
But then I met Nikki. I was lying outside at the pool, looking out over the water, high off my ass. And this incredibly handsome, tall, elegant-looking man came out, and he was smoking a cigarette, and I said, "Can you put that out, please? Because I hated smelling smoke unless I was smoking." And he said, "You think just because you're gorgeous, you get what you want." And he had this fabulous Italian accent. I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, then, you are right." And he put out the cigarette. He said, "I'm Niccolò Argento." And I thought that was such a great name. I kept saying it over and over. Niccolò Argento. Niccolò Argento. He bought me a drink, and then I bought him one. And then we did a line or two off the side of the pool, as you do, and then I realized he had no idea who I was, which was sort of a novelty at that point because most people at least knew Honeycomb. So I tell him about the band, and he tells me about himself, that he travels from place to place, never staying anywhere for too long. He calls himself an adventurer. He says he's in search of a full life of experiences. Then it comes out that he's a prince. He's an Italian prince. The next thing I know, it's 4 in the morning and we're in my hotel room, listening to records at full volume, and the hotel staff are telling us to keep it down, and Niccolò has LSD, and he's telling me he loves me. And I'm saying that I know it sounds crazy, but I think I love him too.
I wanted to see her, and I had a few weeks off between gigs, and I was a little worried about her, which at this point was just status quo. So I bought a plane ticket.
Over the next few days, I told Nikki everything. I bared my soul to him. He loved the music I loved, and the art I loved, and the pills I loved. He made me feel like he was the only one that could ever understand me. I told him how lonely I was and how hard it had been to work on that album and how I felt about Billy. I didn't hide anything from him. I opened up and just let it pour out. And he listened to it all. At one point I said, "You must think I'm crazy." And he said, "My Daisy, everything about you makes perfect sense to me." It seemed like there wasn't anything about me, any truth that I could tell him that he wouldn't accept. Acceptance is a powerful drug, and I should know because I've done them all.
I flew into Thailand, and I was exhausted and jet-lagged, and I got on a rickety bus to get to the hotel. I checked in. I asked the concierge what room Lola La Cava was in, and she'd checked out. She was gone.
Nikki and I were at this disco in Patong, and he got this idea that we should pack up and go to Italy. He said, "I have to show you my country." I must have called somebody and booked 2 tickets to Florence at some point because these tickets just showed up at the door one morning. So Nikki and I flew to Italy, and I swear, I was halfway there before I remembered Simone was on her way to meet me.
I tracked her down by pretending to be her while talking to her credit card company.
Nikki and I were in the Boboli Gardens in Florence when he said, "Let's get married." So, then we flew to Rome and got married by some family friend of his who was a priest. We said I was Catholic. I lied to a Catholic priest, but I was wearing this gorgeous ivory off-the-shoulder cotton lace dress with huge bell sleeves. I regret that marriage, but I do not regret that dress.
I finally found Daisy in this grand, massive hotel room overlooking Vatican City in Rome. In Rome! I had to fly halfway around the world and back to find her. And when I did, she was completely bombed, naked except for a pair of underwear, and she had chopped her hair off into this shaggy bob.
That was a great haircut.
It was a really good haircut.
I've always said, the Italians know hair.
Daisy didn't even seem all that surprised to see me, but just told me how messed up she was. And the first thing I noticed when I sat down was that she had a huge diamond ring on her hand. And this guy comes out, thin body, thick curly hair, and he had no shirt on. And Daisy says, "Simone, this is my husband, Niccolo."
Technically, marrying Niccolo made me a princess. That can't be left out of the equation. I did like the idea of belonging to a huge royal family. Of course, that's not what my life with Nikki was like at all. I should have known being with Nikki wouldn't turn out the way he made it seem. Here's a lesson for everybody. Take it from me. Handsome men that tell you what you want to hear are almost always liars.
I tried to get her to come home, but she wasn't budging. Because when I would tell her there were things she had to do, "You have to get ready to tour for your album," or "You should stop doing so many drugs at one time," or "You should try to spend a little time sober," there was Nikki, telling her she didn't have to do anything she didn't want to do. He was there, amplifying all of her bad instincts, all the time. He was like a bird chirping in her ear, validating every impulse.
Karen. When we all met back up in January, Daisy wasn't anywhere to be found.
Graham. We are sitting in Teddy's office over at Runner with Rich Valentino, and we're all going to give the final mix a listen. And we were all expecting to, well, we all figured we knew exactly what we'd recorded, give or take.
Warren. I was hungover and there was no coffee in either of the coffee pots at Runner's offices. I said to the secretary at the front desk, "What do you mean there's no coffee?" And she said, "The machine is broken." I said to her, "Well, I'm sure as shit not going to be alive in this meeting then." She said, "You're too much." And then she seemed a little bit mad, like I couldn't get a read on her. And I was really hungover. I said, "Wait, I haven't slept with you, have I?" I had not.
The album starts playing. We're all sitting around the table.
First song out of the gate, Chasing the Night, he changed my fucking lick. He changed my motherfucking lick.
I don't think I realized until we were listening to it all together. I don't think I realized just how many things Teddy and I had changed.
It just got worse from there. He changed the tuning on Please, completely changed it, and re-recorded it. As if I wasn't going to notice he'd shifted to Nashville tuning. Like I'm not going to notice that the song has to be played on a different goddamn guitar. And everybody else, they saw it. They could see what he'd done. But no one was going to speak up, you know what I'm saying? Because Teddy and Runner were so happy with the record that they were talking about booking stadiums and pressing over 100 masters and all this shit. They're saying they want to release Turn It Off as soon as possible, and they think he can hit number one. So everybody had dollar signs in their eyes, and nobody said much of anything to Billy. Or Teddy.
He'd pulled my keys off of two songs, and I was mad. Of course I was mad. But what were we going to do? You've got Rich Palantino so excited about the album, he's spitting when he talks.
I'd have respected it a lot more if Billy hadn't tried to pretend he wasn't producing the album with Teddy. I don't like underhanded shit. I don't like saying one thing and doing another. But I was also the drummer in a successful rock band that everybody was saying was headed to the top of the charts. I've always had a good sense of perspective, if I do say so myself.
Rod. That's when the whispering started. Everybody stopped talking to each other and all started whispering to me. Karen would say, "He took out my keys and he didn't even run it by me." And I'd say, "You have to talk to him about it." And she wouldn't. And P would say that the record was too soft now, that he was embarrassed by it. And I'd say, "Talk to Billy about it." I'd say to Billy, "You need to talk to your bandmates." He'd say, "If they want to talk to me, they'll talk to me." And everybody's wondering when Daisy's coming back, but I'm the only one willing to track her down.
It was a strange reminder that things were changing, that we weren't the same band we were a few years ago. A few years ago, if Billy was going to re-record Eddie's tracks, he would have talked to me about it. He would have bounced the idea off of me. Instead, he was talking to Teddy. But that was true of a lot of things between Billy and me. I had Karen, he had Camila and his girls. And when he wanted to talk about ideas, well, at least throughout the recording of Aurora, he had Daisy. I'm not going to say I was feeling like Billy didn't need me anymore, that's dramatic, but maybe I was feeling like we weren't a team all the time anymore, that we'd outgrown that. You know, I think a lot of how I defined myself was in relation to him. I always, my whole life until that point, I always felt like Billy Dunn's little brother, and that was when it occurred to me that he probably never defined himself as Graham Dunn's older brother. Would never have thought to.
In hindsight, I can see why they were mad. But I don't regret any work I did on that album. The work speaks for itself.
It's so complicated. Was the album our best one because Billy was forced to let us in on the composing and arranging from the outset? I think so. Was it the best one because Billy ultimately took the reins back? Because Teddy knew when to make Billy listen to other ideas and when to let him run the show? Was it only the best because of Daisy? I have no idea. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I have no idea. But when you're a part of something as big as that album ended up being, you want to know if you were an integral part. You want to believe they couldn't have done it without you. Billy never did put much effort into making everyone feel integral.
All bands have trouble with this stuff. You know how hard it is to get this many people to agree on anything this subjective?
Artie Schneider. I heard little inklings of grief later, that some of the band weren't happy with the changes, or maybe the way the changes were handled, but I thought it was sort of odd, the way everyone was getting upset at Billy as if he was in charge. Teddy was in charge. If Billy redid Eddie's tracks, it's because Teddy thought Billy should redo the tracks. I never once saw Billy do anything Teddy wasn't backing. I even made a joke once, when Teddy was out of the room. Billy had wanted to take out the dobro on some song, but Teddy wanted it in. When Teddy was gone, I said, "Should we just go ahead and take it out and see if he notices?" Billy shook his head. Really serious. He said, "Biggest hit we've had was a song I thought I hated. Teddy's the only one that saved it." He said, "If it comes down to his opinion or my opinion, we go with his opinion."
Simone. I finally got Daisy to agree to buy a plane ticket to be back in LA for the start of rehearsals.
When I told Nicky it was time for me to go back to L.A., he wasn't very supportive. The band had to do press and pre-release stuff. We had to get ready to head out on tour, and he knew that. I had told him all of that when we met. But he said, "Don't go. Stay here. The band doesn't mean anything." And that hurt, because the band meant everything. This thing that felt like all of my worth, he treated it like it was nothing. I'm embarrassed to say he almost had me. I almost didn't leave for the airport. Simone knocked on the door and Nicky said, "Don't answer it." I said, "It's Simone. I have to answer it." She was standing there and she had this furious look on her face I'll never forget. She said, get your fucking suitcase and get in the cab now. I'd never seen her like that. And something just sort of clicked in me. You have to have one person in your life that you know would never do anything to steer you wrong. They may disagree with you, they could even break your heart from time to time, but you have to have one person at least who you know will always tell you the truth. You need one person who, when the shit hits the fan, grabs your stuff, throws it in a suitcase, and gets you away from the Italian prince.
I dragged her ass home.
Daisy comes back from this month-long vacation, and she's somehow 10 pounds lighter than when she left, which, you know, Daisy didn't have 10 pounds to lose. And she's cut all of her hair off, and she's got a diamond ring on, and she's a princess.
I was floored. I mean, absolutely, positively floored. My jaw about hit the floor when she showed up married.
What did he care, honestly? What did he care? That's what I was thinking. He was married. I couldn't be married.
Warren, let's not go crazy here. She married the son of a prince. When she got back, I asked her how many people had to die before this guy was king, and she said, well, technically the Italians don't have a monarchy anymore, so that doesn't sound like much of a prince to me.
Rod, we were slating the album for release that summer. As it got closer, we started sending the finished record out to critics and magazines. We had a lot of requests for interviews. We wanted a big, splashy magazine cover to hit the stands right as the album came out. Obviously, we wanted Rolling Stone, and Daisy specifically wanted Jonah Berg again. So I made the call, and he agreed to do it.
Jonah Berg. The plan was that I was going to hang out with them during rehearsals. I did feel a certain connection with them, the band, because I knew that it had been my article that had pushed them into doing an album together. So, if I thought the album sucked, that would have been a little embarrassing. But I was really blown away by it. Lyrically, there was a lot going on. Billy and Daisy were credited equally, and some of the most gripping songs were ones where they were credited together. So I was coming into the situation assuming that the story here was that Billy and Daisy had an intense collaborative chemistry.
The first few days of rehearsal, it was really subtle, but if you were paying attention, you'd notice that Billy and Daisy never actually spoke to each other.
Graham, as we were talking about the set for the show, we were all sitting around on the stage, but Billy and Daisy wouldn't address each other directly. I remember Billy suggested we not play Honeycomb anymore, even though it was a big hit for us. He suggested sticking to Aurora and maybe one or two other songs. Daisy looked at me and said, "What do you think, Graham? I think people will expect it. We don't want to disappoint them." I could not understand why she was directing it to me. Before I could even answer, Billy looked at me and said, "But it's slow. We have to keep in mind we're playing bigger venues. We need stuff that plays to a crowd." I was about to ask Billy if that meant he didn't want to do A Hope Like You either, because that's also a slow one. But before I could, Billy said, "So, that settles it then." And Daisy said, "Well, what does everybody else think?" And the whole time, they weren't even making eye contact. We were all standing around watching them talk near each other.
The first day we rehearsed, I came in with a good attitude. I said to myself, "This is somebody I need to work with. Forget whatever chaos is going on. This is a professional relationship." Tried to put my personal issues with her aside, and you know what? I was still mad about her calling for a vote on Regret Me. Yeah, I was. But it was water under the bridge. It had to be. So I made sure that my tone was kind, and I kept my nose to the grindstone.
I was ready to put all of that crap between Billy and me in the past. I was married now. I was trying to keep my focus on Nikki. I was really trying to make it work. Nikki had finally agreed to join me as we went into rehearsals. He flew in from Rome and moved into my place at the Marmont. He even had dinner with my folks. I almost never had dinner with my folks, but I asked them if they wanted to meet him, and they invited us out to Shay J. He was incredibly polite and sweet and really impressed them. He pulled out the whole yes, Mrs. Jones, no, Mr. Jones thing, and they liked that. And then the minute we got to my car afterward, he said, "How can you stand those people?" And I smiled about as wide as humanly possible. I liked being married. I liked the idea of us being a team, of being tied to this one person. I had somebody who asked how my day was every day.
Simone, in theory, marriage made a lot of sense for Daisy. She needed stability back then. I mean, she's always been my best friend, always will be. But she wanted someone to share her life with. Someone who loved her and cared about her and worshipped her. She wanted someone that, when she wasn't home by a certain time, would wonder where she was. So, I understood what she was trying for. I wanted that for her, too. She just picked the wrong person for the wrong reasons.
Obviously, there were a lot of signs that I'd made a wrong turn. Niccolo was deeper in the dope than I was. I was the one telling him to slow it down. I was the one turning down heroin. I was the one noticing just how much we were putting on my credit cards. And he was very threatened by Billy. He was jealous of anyone that I had previously dated or had feelings for, and anyone that he perceived as someone I might possibly sleep with. At the time, I chalked it up to newlywed problems. They say the first year of marriage is the hardest, and I really took that to heart back then. I wish someone had told me that love isn't torture, because I thought love was this thing that was supposed to tear you in two and leave you heartbroken and make your heart race in the worst way. I thought love was bombs and tears and blood. I did not know that it was supposed to make you lighter, not heavier. I didn't know it was supposed to take only the kind of work that makes you softer. I thought love was war. I didn't know it was supposed to be peace. And you know what? Even if I did know that, I don't know that I would have been ready to welcome it or value it. I wanted drugs and sex and angst. That's what I wanted. Back then, I thought that the other type of love, I thought that was for other types of people. Honestly, I thought that type of love didn't exist for women like me. Love like that was for women like Camila. I distinctly remember thinking that.
Niccolo had a lot of good qualities. He did. He cared about her. He made her feel secure in his own way. He used to make her laugh. They had inside jokes I never understood. Something about the game Monopoly, I don't know. But he genuinely made her laugh. And Daisy had such a great smile. And she'd been unhappy for a while. But he was possessive. And you can't own anybody. Let alone somebody like Daisy.
I met Niccolo and I went, oh, okay, got it. This guy's a con artist.
I kind of like Niccolo. He was always real cool with me and Pete.
Niccolo came down to the studio to hear us rehearse a lot. There was one day when Daisy and we were rehearsing the vocal harmonies and it wasn't jibing. We had a few moments of downtime and I said to her, maybe we need to shift this into a different key. That was more than I'd said to her in I don't know how long, but Daisy just said it was fine the way it was. I said, if you can't hit the note exactly, we have to change something. She rolled her eyes at me, and I apologized because I didn't want to make a scene. And I said, okay, I'm sorry, and I just figured it would work itself out. But she just said, I don't need your apologies, all right? I said, I'm just trying to be nice. She said, I'm not interested in your nice. And then she shivered. And it was cold in the studio, and she was wearing basically nothing. She looked cold to me. And I said, Daisy, I'm sorry. Let's just be on good terms, all right? Here, take my shirt. I had on a t-shirt and then a button down over it, or maybe I was wearing a jacket or something. Anyway, I took it off and I put it around her arms. And she shrugged it off and she said, I don't need your fucking jacket.
Billy always knows best. He knows when you're not singing right. He knows how you should fix it. He knows what you should be wearing. I was so sick of being told by Billy how things were going to go.
I was sick and tired of being treated like I was her problem. She was my problem. And all I tried to do was give her my jacket.
I didn't want his coat. What did I want his coat for?
Daisy was raising her voice a little bit, and the minute she did, Niccolo just came running in.
He was over by the couches we had in the corner next to the cooler of beers. He always wore blazers over his t-shirts.
That fucker was drinking all the good beers.
He came running in towards me and grabbed me by my shirt, and he said, what's the problem here? I knocked his hand away, and I could tell by the look on his face when I did it that he was trouble.
I was watching it happen, this fight brewing, and I was thinking, at what point do I step in here? I'm worried Billy's gonna clock him.
You wouldn't have thought at first that Niccolo was tough because he was so smarmy and he wasn't muscular or anything. And he was supposedly some prince or what have you. But I watched him puff out his chest a bit. And look, Billy's a formidable guy. But you just got this sense that Niccolo was a little bit unhinged.
There's a code to two men fighting it out. You don't punch the nuts. You don't really kick. You never bite. Niccolo would have bitten. You could just see it.
Could I have taken him out? Maybe. I don't think he wanted to fight any more than I did.
I was not quite sure what to do. I think I just waited, watching it happen.
He said, you stay away from her, okay? You work together and that's it. You don't talk to her, you don't touch her, you don't even look at her. I thought that was bullshit. I mean, sure, this guy can try to tell me what to do, but he shouldn't tell Daisy what to do. I turned and I looked at Daisy and I said, is this what you want? She looked away for a moment, then she looked back at me and said, yes, that's what I want.
Oh, the tangled messes I've created in my life.
I couldn't believe it, that she would. I had trusted her, when all signs said that I shouldn't. And I was done doing that. Completely done doing that. She was exactly who I'd thought she was. And I felt like I'd been an idiot for thinking otherwise. I put my hands up and I said, all right, man. You won't hear a peep from me.
I couldn't believe it. Somebody had actually put Billy Dunn in his place.
Karen, it was that afternoon, or maybe the next day, that Jonah Berg came by for the first time. I was on pins and needles, I think we all were, because Billy and Daisy wouldn't even look at each other. We rehearsed Young Stars all afternoon, and even when they were singing together, in harmony, they weren't looking at each other.
Jonah Berg. I show up, and I'm expecting this warm atmosphere. I mean, this is a band that has just finished a great album. One where they are clearly all on the same page, working together seamlessly. Or so I thought. But I walk in, and they're in the middle of a song, and Daisy and Billy are about as far away from each other as two people can be while still on the same stage. It was visually very jarring. You don't realize how often singers stand close to one another until you see two people facing forward, 15 feet between the two of them, not even looking at each other.
Graham, I kept thinking, just get it together while this guy is here.
In this instance, I'd say it was on Daisy to fix what had just happened, and she wasn't going to do that.
But even with this tension in the room, the band sounded great, and the songs they were playing were great. That's one thing that the Six has always done, and they did it even better when they had Daisy on board. They made music that it could be the first time you heard a song, but you were tapping your foot along with them That's a testament to the work of Warren Rhodes and Pete Loving. Daisy Jones and the Six get a lot of credit for the intrigue of their lyrics, and certainly everyone's paying attention to Billy and Daisy, as well they should. But that was one hell of a rhythm section.
I asked Rod at some point if we could reschedule Jonah to another day.
It was too late to move Jonah. He was already there watching them rehearse.
I didn't see why Billy had to make such a big deal out of it. We could easily have just made nice in front of Jonah Berg.
After a few songs, they take a break. They all come say hi to me at various points. I shared a cigarette with Warren outside, and I figured he was my best chance at the truth. I said, level with me. Something's up here. And he said, nothing's up. Just kind of shrugged his shoulders like he had no idea what I was talking about. And I trusted him. I believed that nothing out of the ordinary had happened, that this was just the way they worked together. Billy and Daisy just truly didn't get along, and probably never really had.
I think it was that night that Jonah wanted to take us all out for a beer, but I had told Camila I'd be home to help her get the kids in the bath, so I asked Jonah if he could do the next night, and it didn't seem to be a problem for him.
We're all supposed to be putting this band first, and Billy blows off the first night we're supposed to be hanging out with Rolling Stone for the cover.
I figured it was good news Billy was going home. I could take the first swing at the interview without worrying about him being around.
Jonah Berg. I appreciated that Daisy made herself available to me. So often you go into a situation and you have certain band members that won't really talk to you. Daisy made it easy to get a story.
Daisy didn't want to go home. You know when you're with someone and it's clear they want to just keep hanging out, keep partying all night, keep working all night, keep doing whatever it is all night because they don't want to go and face whatever they have waiting for them at home? That was Daisy when she was married to Niccolo.
We all go out that night, everybody but Billy. First, we head out to this Bad Breaker show over on the Strip, and it seems really obvious to me that Karen and Graham must be sleeping together. And I say to them, I said, are you two an item? And Graham says yes, and Karen says no.
I didn't understand. I just didn't understand, Karen.
Graham and I could never last. It was never... I just needed it to exist in a vacuum, where real life didn't matter, where the future didn't matter, where all that mattered was, you know, how we felt that day.
Warren seemed busy hitting on every woman he could find, and Eddie Loving was talking my ear off, talking about tuning or something. Pete was off with some girl he was seeing, so I decided to focus on Daisy. She was who I wanted to get the most from anyway. Now, I will say this. A lot of people were getting high on whatever they could get their hands on back then. That wasn't anything new. And even as a journalist, there wasn't much you couldn't allude to in the pages of a magazine, certainly one like Rolling Stone. You could imply all sorts of stuff about what everybody was getting up to. But there were some people who didn't seem like they were snorting things for fun. There were some people out there who were getting high because they couldn't hold it together without it. And it was my personal opinion that the drug habits of those people were sort of off limits. A lot of people in my position felt differently. A lot of them behaved differently, wrote differently. I certainly got into a few situations over the years where I felt pressured, or was pressured, I should say, to out those people in the interest of selling magazines. So I tended to not even write down what I observed, or tell a single person what I saw, if I thought somebody I was interviewing had a serious drug problem. It was a very see no evil sort of thing for me. When I'm with Daisy that night, we are hanging out in the back of the crowd, and I look over and Daisy is rubbing her gums, and at first I thought it was coke, but I realized she was snorting amphetamines. She did not seem like a recreational user, I guess is what I'm saying. And there seemed a significant difference in the Daisy I met on tour the year before and this Daisy now. She was more frenetic, less eloquent, sadder maybe, no, that's not it. Less joyful. She said to me, do you want to go outside? I nodded, and we went into the parking lot, and we sat on the hood of my car. And Daisy said, All right, Jonah, let's do this. Ask your questions. And I said, if you don't want to go on the record now because you're not in the right state of mind, you need to say so. And she said, no, let's talk. I had given her an explicit out, and she turned it down. That's all I felt obligated to do. So I said, what's going on between you and Billy? Then it all just started pouring out of her.
I shouldn't have said what I said. And then Billy shouldn't have gone and done what he did.
Billy. I come into the rehearsal space the next day, and everybody's there, and they're all talking and messing around, and Jonah says, when should we set aside some time to talk? And I say, let me see when Daisy's free. And he says, well, I want to get some time just the two of us, if you're good with that. That's when I started to get worried. Just the way he said it, I sort of had this feeling like, what did she do? I looked over at her, and she was up at the mic talking to somebody, and she had on tiny shorts again in this cold studio, and I just thought, put some fucking pants on. And that's what I was thinking. You're cold. Stop dressing like it's going to be hot in here. You know it's cold in here every day. But of course she was hot. She was sweating bullets from all the drugs in her body. I knew that.
Daisy. I think that if I had gone up to Jonah that day, after talking to him that night and tried to take it all back, he might have let me. And I considered it. I really did.
Jonah Berg. I absolutely would not have agreed to let Daisy rescind her comments. People have asked it before. I've always said no. That's why I'm very clear at the beginning when I start recording. I make sure people understand what they are doing when they talk to me. I gave Daisy plenty of outs. She moved forward. At that point, the question of integrity shifts from being my problem to her problem.
So we rehearse for the morning, and Daisy and I just can't get the harmony right in the last verse of the song, but I don't want to get into a fight with her in front of Jonah. I also don't want to be performing this poorly in front of him either. The last thing I want is an article that says that we don't have what it takes live. So when we break, I ask Graham to talk to her, and he agrees, and Daisy and I, for at least the rest of that session, just sort of communicated through Graham.
Graham. I mean, how was I supposed to keep track of their bullshit? Who's not talking to who, when, and for what goddamn reason? I've got my own problems. I've got my own heart cracking, man. I'm in love with a woman that I'm starting to think doesn't love me, and I'm not telling a single soul about it, and you don't see me asking for intermediaries to save me from my own brand of crap, do you?
After we call it a day, I go out with Jonah, and I'm sitting there, banging the 57 on a bottle of ketchup, when he says, Daisy says you spent your first tour cheating on your wife and dealing with alcoholism and drug addiction, possibly a heroin addiction. She says you're in recovery now, but that you missed the birth of your first daughter because you were in rehab.
Warren. I don't consider myself to be very high on the list of good people, but you don't tell other people's stories.
I did so many stupid things back then. Basically, for all of the 70s. I did a lot of things that hurt people or hurt myself, but that one has always stuck out to me as one I particularly regret. Not just because of Billy, although I did feel badly that I shared something he told me in confidence, but I regret it more because I could have hurt his family. And I would never want to do that. Truly.
You know, one of the things you learn in recovery is that self-control is the only control we have. That all you can do is make sure your own actions are sound because you can't control the actions of others. That's why I didn't do what I wanted to do, which was take the bottle of ketchup and throw it at the window. And I did not reach across the table and wring Jonah Berg's neck. And I did not get in the car, find Daisy, and start screaming at her. I did not do any of those things. I stared right at him, and I could feel my breath growing really hot. I could feel my chest expanding up and down. I felt like a lion, like I was capable of destroying him. But I closed my eyes, I stared at the back of my own eyelids, and I said, "Please do not print that."
Jonah Berg. That confirmed for me that it was true. But I said, "If you can give me something else to write about, then I won't. I mean, I told you, I don't like printing secrets when they're sad. I got into journalism to tell rock and roll stories, not to tell depressing ones. Give me rock stars sleeping with groupies. Give me the crazy shit you did on PCP. Great, but I've never liked publishing depressing shit. People's families falling apart and all that. I said, give me something rock and roll." That felt like a win-win. And Billy said, "How about this? I can't fucking stand Daisy Jones."
I will tell you exactly what I said. It's right there in the article. I said, "She's a selfish brat who's been given everything she wants her entire life and thinks it's because she deserves it."
When he said, "Talent like Daisy's is wasted on people like Daisy," I went, "Oh, wow. Okay, here is a great article." It was a way more interesting story to tell, in my opinion. What's going to sell more copies? Billy Dunn used to be an alcoholic and now he's reformed? Or the two lead singers in this hip new band loathe each other? It was no contest. The world was filled with Billy Dunns. So many men in this world missed their daughters' births or stepped out on their wives or whatever else he did. Sorry to say it, but that's the world we live in. But not many people are so creatively in sync with someone they despise. That was fascinating. My editor loved the idea. He couldn't have been more amped about it. I told the photographer what I wanted for the cover, and he said it would be easy enough to splice together from the photos he had taken. So I went back to New York, and I wrote that article in 48 hours. I never write articles that fast, but it was just so easy. And those articles are always the best ones. The kind you swear wrote themselves.
Graham, the entire point of having Jonah Berg out with us was so that he could write an article about what a smart move it was to have Daisy join the band. And instead, he writes about Billy and Daisy hating each other.
Eddie, it felt like those two assholes let their own personal crap taint the band and the music and all the hard work we'd all put into it.
Rod, it all landed so perfectly. The band just couldn't see it. They couldn't see how great it was. We released Turn It Off as the first single. We booked the band on Midnight Special. We had them doing radio spots all over the country leading up to the album dropping. And then, the same week Aurora hits the shelves, so does the Rolling Stone cover. Billy's profile shot on one side, Daisy's on the other. Their nose is almost touching. And it says, "Daisy Jones and the Six are Billy Dunn and Daisy Jones rock and roll's biggest foes."
Warren, I saw that and I just had to start laughing. Jonah Berg always thinks he's one step ahead when he's two steps behind.
Karen, if there was any chance that Billy and Daisy were going to put the pettiness behind them and work together, really work together, over the course of the tour, I think that magazine interview ended it. I don't think there was much coming back from it.
Is there any headline that is going to make you want to see Daisy Jones and the Six perform live more than that?
Billy, I didn't care if Daisy was mad at me. I didn't care one bit.
Daisy, we both did things we shouldn't have. When someone says your talent is wasted on you, and he says it to a reporter knowing full well it's going to make it into print, you aren't really inclined to mend fences.
You can't claim the high ground when you go around throwing other people and their families under the bus.
There's no Diamond Record without that Rolling Stone article. That article was the first step in their music transcending the limits of music. It was the first step toward Aurora being not only an album, but an event. It was the last kick it needed to blast off.
Turn It Off debuted at number 8 on the Billboard charts.
Aurora came out June 13, 1978, and we didn't hit with a splash. We hit with a cannonball.
Nick Harris, rock critic. This was an entire album people had been waiting for. They wanted to know what would happen when you put Billy Dunn and Daisy Jones together for an entire album. And then they drop Aurora.
Camila. The day the record hit the shelves, we took the girls down to Tower Records. We let Julia buy her own copy. I was a little wary of it, to be honest. It wasn't exactly child-friendly, but it was her dad's album. She was allowed to have her own copy of it. When we left the store, Billy said, "Who's your favorite member of the band?" And I said, "Oh, Billy." And Julia pipes up and goes, "Daisy Jones!"
Jim Blades. I was playing the Cow Palace the day Aurora came out, I think, and I had a row to go down to the record store and get it so I could listen to it. I remember sitting there, before we were about to go on, listening to This Could Get Ugly, smoking a cigarette, thinking, why didn't I think to get her to join my band? The writing was on the wall. They were gonna eclipse all of us. With that cover, too. That cover was perfect California summer rock and roll.
Elaine Chang, biographer, author of Daisy Jones, Wildflower. If you were a teenager in the late 70s, that cover was everything. The way Daisy Jones carried herself, the way she was in full control of her own sexuality, the way she showed her chest through her shirt, but it felt like it was on her own terms. It was a seminal moment in the lives of so many teenage girls. Boys, too, I understand. But I'm much more interested in what it meant for girls. When you're talking about images in which a woman is naked, subtext is everything. And the subtext of that photo, the way her chest is neither aimed at Billy nor at the viewer, the way her stance is confident, but not suggestive. The subtext isn't that Daisy is trying to please you or the man she's with. The subtext isn't, my body is for you, which is what so many nude photos are, what so many images of naked women are used for. The subtext for her body in that image, it's self-possession. The subtext is, I do what I want. That album cover is why I, as a young girl, fell in love with Daisy Jones. She just seemed so fearless.
Freddie Mendoza. It's funny. When I shot the album cover, I thought it was just a gig. Now, all these years later, it's all anybody asks about. That's what happens when you do something legendary, right? Oh, well.
Greg McGinnis, former concierge, the Continental Hyatt House. Once Turn It Off came out, everybody in town was talking about that record.
Artie Snyder. The week it came out, the very week it came out, I got 3 job offers. People were buying that album, listening to it, loving it, and they wanted to know who mixed it.
Simone. Daisy just blew up. She went from being well-known to being an absolute sensation. She was it.
Jonah Berg. Aurora was a perfect album. It was exactly what we all wanted it to be, but better than we anticipated. It was an exciting band putting out a confident, bold, listenable album from start to finish.
Nick Harris. Aurora was romantic and brooding and heartbreaking and volatile all at once. In the age of arena rock, Daisy Jones and the Six managed to create something that felt intimate, even though it could still play to a stadium. They had the impenetrable drums and the searing solos. They had songs that felt relentless in the best way possible, but the album also felt up close and personal. Billy and Daisy felt like they were right next to you, singing just to each other. And it was deeply layered. That was the biggest thing Aurora had going for it. It sounds like a good time album when you first listen to it. It's an album you can play at a party. It's an album you can get high to. It's an album you can play as you're speeding down the highway. But then you listen to the lyrics and you realize this is an album you can cry to. It's an album you can get laid to. For every moment of your life in 1978, Aurora could play in the background. And from the moment it was released, it was a juggernaut.
It's an album about needing someone and having them love someone else.
It's an album about the push and pull of stability and instability. It's about the struggle that I live almost every day to not do something stupid. Is it about love? Yeah, of course it is. But that's because it's easy to disguise almost anything as a love song.
Jonah Berg. Billy and Daisy was our biggest selling issue of the 70s.
Rod. Rolling Stone did a lot to get people to buy the record, but the real money was in how many people bought tickets to the show because of that article.
You heard the album, and you read about Billy and Daisy and Rolling Stone, and you wanted to see it for yourself. You had to see it for yourself.
Aurora World Tour, 1978 to 1979. With Turn It Off summiting the charts and spending 4 weeks in the top spot, and Aurora selling over 200,000 units every week, Daisy Jones and the Six was the act to see the summer of 78. The Aurora Tour was selling out stadiums and booking holdover shows in major cities across the country.
Rod. It was time to get the show on the road. I mean that literally.
Karen. There was a weird feeling on the buses. And by buses, I mean the blue bus and the white bus. They both said Daisy Jones and the Six across them, but one had Billy's denim shirt in the background and the other was Daisy's tank top. We had two buses because we had so many people, but also because Billy and Daisy never wanted to have to even look at each other.
The blue bus was Billy's bus, unofficially. Billy and Graham and Karen and myself, some of the crew, were normally on there.
Warren. I took the white bus with Daisy and Niccolo and Eddie and Pete. Jenny was with Pete sometimes. The white bus was a much better time. Also, yeah, I'll be on the bus with the tits painted on the window, thanks.
Billy. I had a full sober tour under my belt. I felt all right going back on the road.
Camila. I sent Billy out on tour like I did almost everything with him back then. With hope. That's all I could do, was just hope.
Opal Cunningham, tour accountant. Every day that I went into the office, I knew three things. One, the band would spend more money than they had the day before. Two, no one would listen to my advice about how to curb spending. Three, anything of import, be it as big as baby grand pianos for the suites or as small as Sharpies for the autographs, you had to make sure Billy and Daisy both had the exact same thing. That rider was twice as long as it needed to be because one of them would get mad if the other had something they didn't. I'd call Rod and I'd say, there is no way they need two ping pong tables.
I always said, just clear it, runner will pay. I should have just made a recording of myself saying that. But I understood Opal's job was to make sure we weren't wasting money, and we were wasting a lot of money. But we had the biggest album in the country at that moment. We could ask for whatever we wanted, and it was in Runner's best interest to give it to us.
Eddie. First day out on the road, we stop at some gas station. Pete and I get out and go inside to get a soda or something. Turn It Off was playing on the radio. That wasn't that uncommon. Something like that had happened to us a lot in the past few years. But Pete makes a joke. He says to the guy, "Can you change the station? I hate this song." The guy changes the station, and Turn It Off is on the next station, too. I said, "Hey, man, how about you just turn it off?" He thought that was funny.
Graham. It was the first time I saw how, what's the word I'm looking for, how invested, I guess, people got in the band. Billy and I went to get a burger at a